You're listening to Stories That Matter, a Hawkwood podcast. In this episode, we hear from Matthew McStravick on the importance of even the smallest everyday connections, how good design can enable these, and the upcoming Enroll Yourself program at Hawkwood.
My name is Matthew McStravick. I am a designer, and I work at the kind of intersection of systems and cultures and services. I always focus on the relationships between people as the mechanism for change in any kind of challenge that we're focused on. I developed a startup in London some years ago now called Echo. It's based upon a time banking model, which is probably quite familiar to people. We were really interested in developing a time banking model that worked for different types of organisation and individual people. And through the hardwired equality of our time banking currency, the Echo, we found that people were developing, as well as commercial benefits from trading within our network, they were developing certain type of relationships that, to use a cliche, like the money can't buy, regular money can't buy at least. And we found that people were coming back to us and talking about the special, kind of unusually beneficial relationships that they were developing from trading within Echo. And they were telling us that they were, when they found out that someone was an Echo member, if they met them socially, they'd talk about them treating them as a friend of a friend straight away. That's what anthropologists would call a weak tie or a weak bond relationship. And that's actually really significant. It doesn't usually happen in that way at all. And so I wanted to look a lot more closely at what was going on in those transactions. And what I found from some research was that qualities, yes, definitely the equality of the currency, but also the autonomy that people brought to trading within Echo and a very high degree of presence that they brought as well, meant that what they would experience very often was something called an empathic interaction. When you experience an empathic interaction with someone, there is oxytocin release in the brain. There are feelings of belonging and well-being. And we can find them all over the place. We have them with, you know, friends and family. It can happen in the gaze between lifelong lovers. But equally, it can happen when someone crosses a zebra crossing and they catch your eye and say thanks for stopping. Or when someone holds open a door for you and you make eye contact and maybe you smile, say thanks very much. It's these tiny little micro interactions that we can have that give us this empathic interaction. It's hugely beneficial to us. So I was really interested in where else these empathic interactions might be happening, what other kind of systems or services there might be. And so I spent some time doing a CLAW fellowship where I focused just on that. There were some organisations, there's a Dutch nursing organisation called Bertzorg, where there are different degrees, but the same characteristics occur and similar kind of experiences of the staff members, the nurses and the patients, in that they take greater levels of care of the experience of the other. They have well-being benefits as a result of interacting in that way. And they're able to do their jobs a lot better. But it's not just Bertzorg, and it's not just lots of non-profits, lots of charities that already behave in this way. But even multi-billion dollar businesses like Airbnb, they do something really similar through the way they design the communication between participants in Airbnb, because it's a little bit more than a customer relationship. You know, they're both sides of the equation are really like participating, and the way that they organise all the, you know, the way that they organise all the messaging between them really accentuates the possibility for an empathic interaction to take place. Actually, they, in their research, they call it emotional engagement, but it's the same stuff, and it's the same qualities: autonomy, equality, and presence. So taking that learning, I, with a dozen or so other designers and thinkers and doers, developed something called Deeper, which is a design studio that focuses upon developing our learning around that, around what the benefits are of optimizing for meaningful human interaction, for those empathic interactions. And we now work with a range of clients in working within their organizations to develop those kind of interactions with patients, passengers, staff members, team members, customers, people. So if there's a system or a service that engages people, most of them do, then there is an opportunity to optimize for meaningful interaction. And lastly on that, it seems what's emerging, and the case is very strong for this, is that there are equally powerful commercial and operational reasons for organizations to develop and to optimize for meaningful human connection as there are social well-being benefits. So now we're working with Hawkwood and Enroll Yourself to run a learning marathon over 6 months with two residentials here at Hawkwood to support 12 people designing and developing services within their organisations, to support them to develop those with greater human connection. And we'll be learning together. So I'll be taking part in the programme as well. My learning question, if you like, will be how can we best support people to develop these services? And the overarching theme is, yeah, just one of like, how do we embed more meaningful human connection into the systems and services that we all engage in every day?
You've spoken a bit about how we can embed these connections, but I think it's really useful to have examples of systems that kind of prevent these connections from being made and the kind of impact that has.
Yeah, you don't need to look far. The overwhelming majority of the systems and services that we engage in every day are designed in ways to minimize those opportunities. Now, they would say that they don't do that, but what they do is seek to reduce friction in services. So self-checkouts at the supermarket, tapping in when you get on the bus. I can sign in at the doctor's now without speaking to anyone. I just tap on the screen when I arrive there. And we're usually trying to reduce all friction in services so that to make them more efficient. But actually, that's a false economy. What we're doing is reducing any opportunity for friendly friction, positive friction. And actually, what we're finding is that we are engaging more and more in systems that reduce the opportunity for meaningful human connection as we go through our lives. We're spending less time with the people who we naturally have empathic interaction with, so our friends and family, and more time, even if it's just sitting on the bus next to people, more time with people who we can't readily have those interactions. That's a real shame. It's particularly bad because those tiny interactions with strangers are actually the highest indicator of whether someone is going to live a long life. So people in a large longitudinal study that's run in Sardinia, they found that the people who lived beyond 100, the highest indication of people likely to be centenarians was not healthy eating, wasn't stopping drinking or smoking, it wasn't even deeper relationships with their friends and family. It was the amount of tiny connections, interactions that they had with strangers. So it's the evidence is really quite powerful, but we have some work to do with the systems and services that we already engage with so that swiping left is not the kind of de facto way that we engage, that we navigate through our lives.
One thing that I was struck by that you just mentioned when talking about those outcomes of empathic interaction are the kind of commercial benefits.
Mm.
And I wonder if there's a concern that in valuing empathy through things like GDP or productivity or these commercial benefits, will that not perhaps undermine empathy after a while?
Yeah, or empathic interaction. So you're raising a really good point. Charles Eisenstein talks about the dangers of, you know, employing the kind of the measures and language of the existing paradigm in essentially enabling that to continue and kind of, you know, supporting it by doing that, and that we shouldn't do that. We should talk from a completely different paradigm. And that's really powerful to me. That said, in my experience of developing and launching different social enterprises, I try to speak using the language that I think will most appeal to the immediate needs of those who I'm messaging, and that's a real tension for me. And I'm completely open to challenge on it. But my experience of being able to affect change is through being able to do just that. So I know that there are huge benefits of weaving empathic interaction, you know, optimizing for meaningful connection between people into systems and services. And I want to do that at scale. And in order to do that, I need to speak to those people who are making decisions around those, you know, large systems and services, so that and to do that, we need to speak to their immediate needs, not solely their immediate needs. And I know that when I speak to many people in corporates and like national infrastructure, actually deeper human connection is something that they yearn for in their lives, and recognize that it could be beneficial to the systems that they're in as well. But they still work within those systems. So trying to message both of those value systems, if you like, is the way that we found we can get traction.
Can you give some examples of how we can optimize empathic interaction?
Yeah, so we've done some work most recently with a charity in the north that support women in crisis of various kinds, and they're interested in becoming more of a being organisation and less of a doing organisation. That's their words. And effectively what they mean by those is that they want to reduce the difference between their staff members and the women that they support. And so we went to do some work finding out exactly how they're already interacting with the women that they support, and identifying ways that they can come together with more equality, autonomy and presence. And you know, sometimes it's really simple things, like rather than sitting opposite someone, having them sit next to you, rather than fill in someone's details on a computer, sit next to them and ask them the questions, or even get them to fill out, you know, to use the computer themselves. There are some instances where, in this case, people are delivering a service to women, and so there are different levels of equality and indeed autonomy and presence that can be achieved. But we're always looking to see where we can apply a little bit of design pressure to turn up the dial on all three of those. Something that's really interesting and something I'm thinking about a lot at the moment, and I'll be thinking about on the learning marathon, is how do we adjust the levels of connection in different systems and services so that they suit people who have different levels of comfort in interacting with strangers or with people. And actually quite often there's quite a large piece of development that we can do before we even start working with people, and that's starting to get us to think about each other more as human beings and less as passengers or clients or customers. The really subtle messages that we send each other when we're, you know, looking down, not making eye contact and so on, are kind of saying you're separate from us. The direct opposite of that is when we do make eye contact and we smile. Essentially what we're saying is, yeah, you're part of my group, my tribe, if you like. And we're kind of sending those belonging messages to people. But actually, by and large, we do almost the opposite of that when we're in systems and services, because we've become so used to being individual units.
Do you see empathic or encouraging empathic interaction as a way of challenging the kind of inequalities and prejudices that we might see in society?
Yeah, I would like to think so. What we found was that people who had become regular echo traders had started to take the different views that they had of echo members, the different perception of them and the different kind of relationships that they'd developed with them, and started to view conventional trading in a similar way and start to question it a little bit. So they would, at the newsagent or the supermarket, they would start to view people slightly differently. That's what they came back and told us. That was particularly exciting because actually if you talk to any systems or sustainability experts I have, they all say that it's that kind of mindset shift that we all need to take towards more of a relational economy and less of a financial economy, an extractive financial economy. And so it's not something that we are directly focusing on right now, but I think, just talking to your point, I think that there is something called contact theory in the States, which relates directly to kind of different racial and cultural groups, and how when they have more direct connection with each other, contact with each other, their prejudices are, if not completely diffused, they are lessened by that. And I think that stands up to common sense. It's great when there's some academic rigor behind it. I would like to see how we can use the lever of empathic interaction to do some experiments with that, but I certainly can't make any grand claims.
I'd like to move on to the enroll yourself scheme now. You did mention it earlier, but could you just explain a bit more how it's going to work and what the kind of aims are?
Yeah, so Zara Davidson, who founded Enroll Yourself, is also a part of the original Deeper kind of advisors and crew. And Ellie Osborne, who is hosting the program, is also part of Deeper. And for a long time, we've been looking for a way to work together. And Enroll Yourself is a really successful existing learning marathon organization that hosts and that facilitates many different learning marathons. Very few of them have a theme in the way that we have. But we were really interested in supporting other people to be able to come on the journey with us. We know that there are lots of people, they're either service designers, and that's their job role, or they're people within organisations whose role it is to develop and design and develop services. And we know that there's a really strong interest in how to do that with greater human connection. We don't have all the answers, far from it. This is a really emergent field, relationship-centred design. And so what we wanted to do was gather the people who are most interested in developing this work together, so that as peers, which is very much in line with our kind of ethos, we can go through a learning marathon over 6 months and support each other on that journey. It starts in November. It starts with a weekend residential at Hawkwood. And indeed, the partnership of Hawkwood came about very simply because Hawkwood had become interested in Deeper. They supported me and others on a social changemakers residency at the beginning of this year. And it was really apparent to all of us who came to that from Deeper that Hawkwood is a living embodiment of empathic interaction. I've just had empathic interaction in the kitchen just now as I was getting my cup of tea. And so we wanted to work with partners who already are kind of exemplars of this way of working and being. So Hawkwood will host the first weekend residential. There'll be another two-thirds of the way through the program, and people come together fortnightly to check in, and once a month to kind of share their learning and support each other. My involvement will be to learn alongside people on the program. It will be to coach some of the participants where that's useful to them, and to collaborate with them on the challenges that they're experiencing in developing those kind of services in their organisations.
If someone's listening and they're kind of interested and think, oh, I might like to come along, how would you sort of persuade them?
Yeah, well, first of all, I would really hope that they could find a link at the bottom of the podcast page to be able to click through. I think if you are thinking about these ideas in your life, if there is a professional/personal desire to bring more human connection into your life, then this is an amazing opportunity to do that, to do it not in a conventional educational program, but in a program that's been designed specifically so that we are able to, as best we can as imperfect human beings, embody these qualities of equality, autonomy and presence through at every juncture throughout the program. It's a really exciting program for me, and the people that we are already coming forwards and want to be involved are an incredible mix of people from different backgrounds, different professional backgrounds, and with really different skills. So I'm really excited about it because I know I'm going to learn an awful lot from the people involved.
So the name of this podcast is Stories That Matter. So I was wondering if you had a story from your life. It can be fact, it can be fiction, it can be something that you've heard or that you've actually experienced that's really influenced what you've gone on to do.
Yeah, there are several. One is something, a story that I heard from the mythologist Martin Shaw. It's the story of Sedna. I'll give you a very imperfect rendition of that, but it's important. Sedna was an Inuit princess who was unmarried and disinterested in the suitors that her father presented to her, to the point where her father became disappointed and decided to do something about it. So he put her in a boat, rowed her out on the lake, and he threw her into the water. And as she struggled to kind of climb out, back out of the freezing cold lake, he used the oar to kind of bash her down. There was no way that she was going to get out. So instead of trying to struggle to get out, she kind of spun and just started swimming deeper and deeper and deeper until she became one with the fish and the weed and the rocks on the bottom and the water itself. She became one with that and became goddess of that lake. Thereafter, every year she would wreak havoc on the village until they had sufficiently sacrificed to her. Now, Martin Shaw wrote about that, blogged about that some time ago. And he said that the kind of mythic reading of that, in relation to many of the challenges, the large seismic existential challenges that we face, is that when faced with something like that, the mythic reading is to go deeper. I remember reading that on the train to London. I remember the effect that it had on me. It was deep, and it's the reason that Deeper has that name from that story. Martin Shaw also says, don't try to trap these stories, these metaphors, these images. Track them, but don't try to trap them. So I won't try to explain more about what that story means, but it means something really important to me.
Thanks for listening to Stories That Matter, a Hawkwood podcast. To find out more about Hawkwood, Deeper, or the upcoming Enroll Yourself programme, follow the links in the show notes. This episode was produced by Laura Bing, with music by Daisy and her Cora, playing an original composition, Berta.